We are in week three of this very personal series, and we're asking a series of questions, and I want to remind you each week, these are questions that the people we're trying to reach for Jesus are asking. So this is not me personally asking you these questions. These are the questions we need to be able to answer for the people we want to lead to Jesus. Remember 2 weeks ago, we talked about, do you know my name? Last week, do you know what matters to me? Today, do you know where I live? Next week, Jimmy will ask the question, do you know what I'm capable of? And then I'll finish the series on the 31st with, do you know what I've done? So today, I'm going to ask the question, do you know where I live? You've heard references before, I'm sure, at least many of you have, to my ancestors and what they were known for. They had this blue tint to their skin. The blue fugates are pretty famous. Anybody ever heard of the blue fugates from Troublesome Creek, Kentucky? Okay, many of you have. We've been in the news, y'all. This is big. Back in the day, and my mom's got pictures, some of my ancestors had this blue tint to their skin. And you've heard of blue bloods. That has nothing to do with the fugates, I'll tell you that. But my dad says, he doesn't even pronounce his last name the way my mom does. If you were to meet them today and they introduced themselves, he would say, I'm Logan Fugate, and she would say, I'm Rose Fugate. And they can't even agree on how to say the last name. My dad says it's because the Fugates were horse or chicken thieves, and the Fugates were horse thieves, and he'd never steal a horse. So he says he's Fugate. Of course, trusting him for pronunciations is a dangerous thing. When he was little, his shoes were so tight, he said, they're cutting off his calculation. And if you're where he's from, that kind of makes sense, if you know what I mean. So we're from Troublesome Creek, and we were the Blue Fugates, and you can't hide this. So my associate minister at my former church, he heard this on the news. It was going around the news in Cincinnati about the Blue Fugates from Troublesome Creek, Kentucky. So I called my mom. I said, is this us? And she said, yeah, honey, it's us. And she showed me these pictures. And so my associate minister at Bright decided he'd show the whole church pictures of my family. And it's the next picture he put up after this. There it is right there. Not funny. So I think after all these years of preaching to you, you all have a pretty good idea where I come from. If not, I'll tell you one story to kick it off about Uncle Bill and Aunt Sarah. You don't see too many people hang gliding in that part of Kentucky. But old John Coons decided he was going to give it a try. Well, he took it to the highest point off of Troublesome Creek, and he went running down the mountain, and he jumped in that hang glider and flying above the trees, and he flies right over Bill and Sarah's cabin. Well, Uncle Bill and Aunt Sarah are out on the porch reminiscing about the good old days when Sarah spotted the biggest bird that she had ever seen in her life. She said, look, Paul, and he looked, and he said, honey, go get the gun. So she runs in the house, and she fetches his pump-action shotgun and brings it out, and he takes careful aim, and boom! And that big bird continues to sail over the treetops, and Sarah said, I think you missed him, Paul. And Bill said, yeah, but at least he let go of old John. You know, I've tried through the years to learn some tact and sophistication and dignity, but I've come to this conclusion. You can't hide hillbilly. It just sticks out all over you. Well, we're in this series about making it personal, and I'm here to tell you today, if you're going to make a difference in people's lives, you have to try harder than you've been trying. You have to get to know their name. Have to know what matters to them. Have to know where they live. I've said it over and over, and I'll continue to say it. You can't know where someone's coming from if you don't know where they come from. So I'm going to make it simple this morning. Remember those books you'd for kids, like See, Spot, Run kind of books? My outline is going to take that kind of approach. It's simple, but it's not simplistic. I want us to see Jesus go to where people live, and then I want us to see Peter go to where people live, and then I want to talk about seeing us going to where people live. Let's start this way. See Jesus go to where people live. Jesus made house calls. If you want proof of that, well, we have Christmas coming up in a couple of months, and we're going to celebrate the fact that Jesus did what? Left where he lived to come where we live. And not only in a physical location, the Hebrew writer puts it this way. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who has been tempted in every way as we are, yet without sin. And I mix these up, Jamie. Go back to John 1:14. John writes, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. He came to where we live. He made a house call. He came to where we live. And during his ministry here on earth, you always find Jesus in a house. I mean, just real quick, Matthew 9, Jesus came into the official's house. Mark 14, while he was in Bethany at the home of Simon the leper. Luke 10, a woman named Martha welcomed him to her home. Luke chapter 5, Levi the tax collector gave Jesus a big reception at his house. Luke 19, Jesus said to Zacchaeus up in the tree, Zacchaeus, you come down. I'm going to your house today. You can't read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John without reading about Jesus going into homes, literally where people lived. Went into the homes of religious people, went into the homes of non-religious people. Went into the rich people's homes, went into the poor people's homes. He did not discriminate. Jesus made house calls. So I want to look today at one of the house calls that he made. Happened early in his ministry. We've talked about the encounter he had with Simon Peter. Remember talking about Jesus knowing what mattered to Peter last week? Peter's a fisherman. Fish mattered to Peter. And Jesus, first thing he said to him was, follow me and I'll do what? Make you fishers of men. Now he goes to his house in Matthew 8, verse 14. When Jesus came into Peter's house, he saw Peter's mother-in-law lying in bed with a fever. He touched her hand and the fever left her. And she got up and began to wait on him. Simon Peter's home was in Capernaum. It's a fishing and agricultural village on the northwest side of the Sea of Galilee. And if you were to do some research, you'd find who all lived in this house with Peter. Peter and his family, Andrew, his brother, and his family, and Peter's mother-in-law. Peter lived with his mother-in-law. See, that's the kind of stuff that jumps right out at me from the Bible. I read this passage, and the first thing I read is, he lived with his mother-in-law. Let me repeat that. Peter lived with his mother-in-law. Danny Armstead, you'd have to know him. He says, true story, he answered his door, the doorbell rang, it was his mother-in-law. She came for a surprise visit, and Danny said, hey, long time no see. How long are you going to be staying? And his mother-in-law said, until you get tired of me. To which Danny said, you won't even stay for a cup of coffee? He lived with his mother-in-law. He comes into the house, and he heals Peter's mother-in-law. And she gets up and immediately does what? Waits on Jesus. And this was before the 1965 Good Housekeeping article that I read you several weeks ago. Now, the city of Capernaum served as home base for Jesus in his ministry. So Jesus knew where Peter lived. But can I let you in on something? He knows where you live too, right? He knows exactly where you live. Jesus knows where we live because he lives in us and we live in him. I love something G.K. Chesterton said. This is so good. He said, there was a man who dwelt in the Middle East centuries ago, and now I cannot look at a sheep or a sparrow or a lily or a wheat field or a raven or a sunset or a vineyard or a mountain without thinking of him. Jesus came from heaven to earth to where we live. He went to where people live. See Jesus go to where people live. See Peter go to where people live. He learned from Jesus. I'll give you one example. There's a good woman in town. Everybody loved her. She did good things for people. Her name was Dorcas. And one day she unexpectedly up and dies. And the people are upset. They love her a lot. And they hear there's a preacher in town. His name is Peter. So they call on Peter to come where they're at, mourning the loss of Dorcas. So Peter goes. Now this flies under the radar, but I can attest to this personally. That's not an easy scene to show up for, is it? You get called to come and be where people are at because someone has died. It's uncomfortable. This is my fourth church. 43 years of ministry. This is my fourth stop along the way. And at all four churches, I've been called to show up at homes where somebody has died. It's happened too many times to count. My first church was on the creek outside of Madison, Indiana. Cute little building. We had to add on, and the creek runs past the church there, and we baptized people in the creek. Didn't have a baptistry. Broke ice one winter to baptize a lady who will never forget her baptism, I'll tell you that. Neither will I. Still thawing out from that one. That was crazy. At my first church, I was 17 years old. I get a call on a Saturday morning, and I go to a home to be greeted by a grieving husband and three blonde girls. He just lost his wife. They just lost their mother. It's the first time I ever helped carry a dead body anywhere. Helped carry the body out of the house. Didn't know what to say. Didn't want to be there. Second church was in Lawrenceburg, Indiana. I was a youth minister there, just 2 years of youth ministry for me, Derek, and I was trying to work my way through college, and I had been there just 2 weeks, and I get a call from a family whose 12-year-old was riding his bike and got too close to the highway, and he was killed by a car. My third church was Bright Christian Church. I served there over 20 years, and I got a call one day and went to Dearborn County Hospital to find out that one of our men in the church had just passed away in a car accident. His wife and kids were en route to the hospital and didn't know that he had died. And the hospital staff wanted me to greet them and give them the news. Never forget it. I'm standing there waiting for them to come in. Again, not somewhere I would want to be. And as soon as she saw my face, she began to scream, "Don't say it, Mark! Don't say it! Don't you say it!" I mean, she was just yelling. "Don't you dare say it!" I said it. She dropped to her knees. I dropped to my knees. If I can be transparent with you, that's hard. It's hard. I don't know what to say. What do you say? I mean, seriously, what do you say? Say anything. Just hold on. It's uncomfortable. But you know what? I need to go and be there. I need to go to the house. I need to go to the hospital. I need to be there. That's how Peter feels. The scene with Dorcas, something he'd just as soon avoid, I'm telling you. He learned from Jesus. He knows he needs to be there, but it's not where he wants to be. Acts 9, 38 and 39, we read this. Lydda was near Joppa, so when the disciples heard that Peter was in Lydda, they sent two men to him and urged him, "Please come at once." Peter went with them, and when he arrived, he was taken upstairs to the room. He's in the house. All the widows stood around him, crying and showing him the robes and other clothing that Dorcas had made while she was still with them. So he's in the house. He's got all these people crying, and there's a dead body there. And why is he there? Well, he learned from Jesus. That's exactly what Jesus would do, and that's exactly what Peter did. Got to go. Got to know where people live. There's a crazier illustration, one of my favorites. You know enough about Peter to know that he's a devout Jew, right? He's never had a BLT, which I can't understand, really. I mean, there's got to be bacon in heaven, right? Please tell me there's bacon in heaven, y'all. Peter never had a bacon sandwich, and the Jews did not associate with non-Jewish people. So Peter's up on a rooftop. We read this in the book of Acts, and we're going to study this in Corey's class eventually, and this is a very cool story. And it's one of those dreams from the Lord. It's a vision where the Lord tells him to eat all these unclean animals that he's avoided all his life. I mean, this is a meat smorgasbord, and he can eat it all. If there was ever proof text for owning guns and eating animals, it's Acts 10:13. Arise, kill, and eat. That ought to be a bumper sticker. It probably is, I would guess. And in the dream, he's told you're going to have people visit your house here soon. And just that quick, there's a knock at the door. So Peter goes down and he invites these people in. Acts 10, 21 through 23. Peter went down and said to the men, "I'm the one you're looking for. Why have you come?" The men replied, "We've come from Cornelius the centurion." Okay, he's a Gentile. "He is a righteous and God-fearing man who is respected by all the Jewish people. A holy angel told him to ask you to come to his house so that he could hear what you have to say." Then Peter invited the men into the house to be his guest. The next day, Peter started out with them, and some of the believers from Joppa went along. So you have a Jewish man inviting these Gentiles into his house so that the next day he can go to the Gentiles' house. And all of Peter's Jewish buddies, not too hip on this. You know, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? Well, because he has to go to where they live. And he does, and Cornelius tells him this incredible story, and Peter baptizes them and stays there for several days. Made me think of a passage that sounds confusing, and it can be, but again, I think we can dumb it down because I think we can tell what Jesus was saying in Matthew 10. This is not on the screen, so listen to this. "Whenever you enter a city or village, search for a worthy person and stay in his home until you leave town. When you enter the home, give it your blessing. If it turns out to be a worthy home, let your blessing stand. If it's not, take back the blessing. If any household or town refuses to welcome you or listen to your message, shake its dust from your feet as you leave." What makes a home worthy? And what makes a home unworthy? Well, in this context, there are two things that would make it worthy. If a house or town refuses to welcome you, so if they're not hospitable, if they refuse to welcome you or listen to your message, and they won't listen to you talk about Jesus. If they're not hospitable and they're not open to the teaching of Jesus, then you are to kick the dust off your feet and move on down the road. That's interesting. You who have been around here a long time, I will apologize for telling this story, but I'll make it quick because I don't know of any better way to make this point. We used to have calling nights at my dad's church in Hanover. Calling night would be where the men would gather and go out two by two, knock on doors, and invite people to come to church. So I went as a junior high boy, not because I enjoyed knocking on doors, but because they had donuts and hot chocolate every calling night. So that was my spiritual reason for being there. And I went, and we do the calling. I always paired off with my dad. He's fascinating to watch, to deal with people. And we get back to church, and it's getting pretty late. And Dad says, "Doggone it, there's a new couple up on the hill. I forgot to get them, and I won't feel good unless we go get them." He said, "Anybody want to go with me?" So I volunteered to go, and we had this elder. He was about 6'5". And he couldn't have weighed more than 102 pounds. Like, he was unbelievable. I mean, he'd stick out his tongue, it looked like a zipper. He just was that thin. And he looked like Lurch from the Addams Family. His name was Redford. And he talked like Lurch. "You rang." I mean, he just that deep voice. And so we're going to go call on this family. And Lurch, Redford says, "I'll go with you." So we gets in the car, and I sit in the back, and I'm just wanting to get this done so we can have the donuts. And so we go to where this family lives, and it's this big, long hill, and we got to park at the bottom. And Dad said, "Redford, I can't drive any closer. I'm sorry about this uphill walk." And Redford said, "Well, I'll just sit this one out." So he stays in the car. Me and my dad go up to the house. My dad bangs on the door like he always did. He's not very tactful, y'all. And if you don't answer the door, he'll bang on the windows. So he knocked, and finally the door creaks open, and the business end of a 12-gauge shotgun comes poking out the door. Well, that don't stop my dad. That's like a welcome mat. "Hey, brother, just here to invite you to church. Got a lot of good things going on. The Sunday school's at 9:30, services at 10:30. We're even going to have dinner next Sunday, and I want to invite you." At that point, the gun cocks. And we hear a voice from inside say this: "I'm getting tired of you Bible thumpers knocking on my door. I'll tell you what I told that old man earlier today. Get off my property or I'm going to shoot you off." That old man sitting in the car, he didn't say a word to us. He knew what we were in for, and he didn't say a word. I was 14 years old. I still remember to the word my exact thought. If I run as fast as I can get back to the car by the time this guy shoots my dad and reloads. So we get in the car. You can picture this, right? And Redford is just sitting there. He's staring right at the dash. My dad won't even start the car. He gets in the car, and he's looking over at Redford, and I mean, awkward silence. And then finally, Redford looks at him and starts laughing and says this, "Well, boys, I think it's best if we shake the dust off our feet and move on." I guess so. And there comes a time, and according to this passage, if you're not welcomed and they're not going to listen to Jesus, it's time to move on to a different home. I wonder how many times Peter entered another home and met people right where they lived, right where they were. See Jesus go to where people live. See Peter go to where people live. And you knew I'd have to close this way. See yourself go to where people live. This is the point in the sermon where you probably say, "Well, Mark, I'm not Jesus." Well, listen, I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, but I'm pretty sure you weren't Jesus. I can figure that much out. Well, I'm not Peter either. No, you're not. You'd never do some of the things he did, good and bad. But you have neighbors, and you have coworkers, and you have family members. Do you know where they live? And I don't mean a physical address. Do you know where they live? Do you know their circumstances? Do you know why they say what they say? Do you know why they're doing what they're doing? Do you know why they feel the way they feel? See, that takes some intent and effort on your part. Anybody tell me who this is? That's it, I heard it. The author, Stephen King. The author of horror books, stories. His books have sold more than 350 million copies. You know some of the titles, right? The Shining, Carrie, Cujo, Pet Sematary, The Green Mile, Misery. This guy's written some dark stuff. The kind of stuff you don't read before you go to bed. If you kept him overnight, you'd sleep with one eye open. Which is what Karen did. We had a cabin in the woods this week in the Smokies just for 5 days. It was awesome. I mean, we were off the grid, baby. It was cool. And we had a tin roof, which I loved. But she would hear things at night on the roof. She swore there was a bear on the roof. There ain't a bear on the roof. So she toughed it as long as she could, but then she had a bad dream about it. So then the last night in the cabin, when I like to hear the dew and the leaves hit the roof, she makes me sleep with the TV on. I Love Lucy was on all night. I Love Lucy, and she had to have the volume up to scare any would-be intruder. And the bathroom light she wanted on, which faced the bed. So while she slept like a baby, I was up all night. Do you know where Stephen King lives, anybody? He's got several houses, but he has picked one to live in primarily. It's in Maine, in Bangor, Maine. Doesn't that house look the part? That kind of looks like a house where Stephen King would live. But just seeing the house doesn't tell you where he really lives. What inspires those twisted plots? What kind of mind do you have to come up with the stuff he does? Well, I don't know if it's about being possessed or insane, but if you read about the things that happened to him when he was a kid, kind of understand. He witnessed a childhood friend being killed by a train. He was abused as a child over and over. Some of the tragic things he experienced as a young adult, most people will never see in their entire life. Now, I want to be clear. I'm not giving you any Stephen King reading endorsements from the pulpit. I'm not doing that. But you need to see where someone came from. It's a little bit easier to see where they're coming from when you know where they came from. So how about you and I going to where people live? Here's three suggestions before we close. Consider just give some consideration where other people live, just to think about where they live, not their physical address, but their experience, their reality. Maybe you have no clue what they're going through. What's it like to be an orphan? I don't know. What's it like to grow up in a foster home? I've had loving parents my entire life. What's it like? What's it like to be disabled? What's it like to be a widow? What's it like to be a soldier who's seen combat? What's it like to be rejected? What's it like to be in jail? What's it like to be a first responder? What's it like to be an immigrant with your whole family? What's it like to be black? What's it like to be a police officer? What's it like to be a committed Christian in today's world? What's it like to be a kid in the corner nobody wants to play with? What's it like to have a spouse with Alzheimer's? What's it like? Hebrews 13:3, pretty pointed. Remember those in prison as if you were together with them. How about that? As if you were together with them in prison. Do you understand me? Do you understand my everyday world? Do you understand what shapes my perspective? Do you understand why I do what I do? Do you understand the history and landscape of my existence? Do you know where I'm coming from? Now, I'm not talking about excusing or condoning bad behavior based on where you live or what your circumstances are. That's not what I'm talking about. There is no excuse for bad behavior, no matter what your upbringing or your race. That's not what I'm talking about. But what I am talking about is if you're serious about bringing people to Jesus, then you have to get to know where they live. One summer, I was the dean at junior high camp. I deaned junior high camp, Derek, for 20-some years. My favorite age, because the little kids would cry, want to go home, and wet their beds in the cabin. I didn't like that at all. The senior high, too cool to get too involved in activities. Junior high, just perfect, man. They ain't going home, and they're energetic, and I loved them. And we had a disability day, disability awareness day. Every camper, for a four-hour period, some were in wheelchairs, which was a bad idea on my part to put junior high kids in wheelchairs at church camp. Not my best move. But for 4 hours, others had earplugs, blindfolded, tape over their mouths so they couldn't talk. I handpicked those kids, by the way. Some walked on crutches. Others had one arm tied to their side. And the idea was just to give them a glimpse of what it might be like if you couldn't see or you couldn't walk or you couldn't hear. What if I couldn't use both hands? How have I been blessed compared to what so many people have to go through? What's it like to be blind? I don't know. I know what I would have missed had I been blind. I'd have missed seeing my son round third and head for home in his little league game. I would have missed that. I would have missed the sunsets we saw this week. I missed that too. My Uncle Jimmy was a great athlete, my mom's brother. He could hit a golf ball 300 yards easily, could hit a softball 300 feet easily. I mean, he just excelled. In his 40s, he came down with MS, and that disease turned my Uncle Jimmy into an old man overnight. Unbelievable. Confined to a wheelchair, he couldn't talk. He'd just make sounds, just grunt, cry all day long. The disease racked our entire family. My cousin Merle was so distraught, he took his own life. And I can tell you, if you wanted to make a difference for my family during that period, you couldn't have done it unless you got to know where we lived. You couldn't have helped unless you tried to get to know what we were experiencing. It'd been the only way you could have offered us any help at all. Consider where we live. Suggestion number two, be the kind of person who causes people to want to let you in on where they live. Just be that kind of person. Man, the world's full of different people, isn't it? I mean, we could have long lines at Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge, and I don't mind sitting and watching people. I mean, it's fascinating. Everybody's different. People are fussing. People got their little kids there, and I look at Karen and say, not us anymore. No way, baby. That's right. Look at that. Two is better. Two is better. That's my motto. And just watching people interact and thinking about all the different people I've seen through the years in ministry. I had an Elvis impersonator in my former church. That was his job. And he was all things Elvis. And I wanted to talk to him about a decision for the Lord. And I knew if I was going to do that, I needed to know more about Elvis than I currently knew. Because I didn't know hardly anything about Elvis. I mean, I knew he was a singer. I knew you ain't nothing but a hound dog kind of stuff. But I didn't really know Elvis. This guy, for a while, thought Elvis was still alive. Now, y'all can laugh, but he was serious. He thought his death had been faked. So I told him I believe it too. I told him I saw Elvis because Elvis sat between me and Bigfoot on the UFO. Seriously? He thought he was alive. So I decided I'm gonna dive into some Elvis stuff and see if I can't build a bridge with this guy. And I did, and we did, and the Lord did, and he came to the Lord and became involved in the church. Wouldn't have happened had I not tried to get to know where he lives. Here's a third suggestion. How about learning to leverage where you live? Let me say something that many of us in the church need to hear. Privilege and blessings are not something to be ashamed of, y'all. They're not. There was a young man named Gabriel Marshall from Kansas. He was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor in 2015, and the resulting surgery left a big scar on the side of his head. So, unable to boost his son's confidence, his dad decided to get his son's scar tattooed on his head. Have you seen this? Is that cool or what? But my favorite, I think, is Alistair Campbell, whose daughter Charlotte received a cochlear implant. So he got a tattoo on his head of her implant. Check this one out. Trying to leverage where they live, trying to go where their children live. I'm asking you today, let's do a better job of getting to know where people live so we can have an opportunity to introduce them to Jesus. Now, without dropping the guilt bomb on you before I close, there are dozens and dozens of people less than 100 yards from this church who don't know Jesus. Do you know where they live? And I don't just mean in the apartments across the parking lot. I mean, do you really know? Do you know where they live? That's where Jesus would go. That's where Peter would go. That's where I need to go. My youngest daughter was very evangelistic at an early age, which could lead to some cool moments, but some embarrassing ones also. She would ask the waiter or waitress at every restaurant we ate at, "Do you know Jesus?" Led to some interesting conversations. I liked it. I liked that she had that fire in her. Well, I caught her playing in a room one day with two of her favorite Cabbage Patch dolls, and I wrote this down all this many years ago. She's 22 now, I think. She was 4 years old, and she was having a conversation between her doll babies. I recorded the whole thing. She called one of her dolls Linda and the other Becca. She wore these Cabbage Patch dolls out. I mean, they got to where they stunk. She'd play with them all the time. And so the conversation went like this. "Hi, Becca." She would hold one up. "I'm Linda. My favorite color is red, and I love to ride horses and eat spaghetti. I think rainbows are cool, and dogs are my favorite animal." Then she would say, "Well, hi there, Linda. I'm Becca. I love to catch lightning bugs and watch cartoons. My favorite thing to eat is tuna sandwiches, and everyone thinks I'm weird because of it. And my favorite person is my cousin Mallory, and I hope you can meet her someday." Then she would always conclude, and she did this with her dolls, she concluded this way, "Now that we're friends, let me ask you if you know Jesus. Because if you don't, I want to tell you about him right now." When you see where someone came from, it's easier to see where they're coming from. This is personal, church. This is personal. About time we get to know where they live. Amen.